Here we're going to talk a little bit more about a very technical, nitty-gritty halacha in a way that contrasts Jewish law and American law. And we're not going to talk much about practice. We're going to talk quite a bit about theory. One of the great dilemmas every legal system has is how to deal with pleading in the alternative. And the common law has a certain traditional approach, which is just absolutely, totally, and completely bizarre. And it goes as follows. I can say things in my common law pleadings that are absolutely, totally, and completely contradictory in a defense. The examples are legendary and famous. They give you many, many, many different examples. In the late 1970s, American Bar Association seminar in New York, Richard Racehorse Haynes gave this example. Say you sue me because you say my dog bit you. Well, now this is my defense. My dog doesn't bite. And second, in the alternative, my dog was tied up that night. And third, I don't believe you really got bit. And fourth, I don't have a dog. And American law is perfectly comfortable with putting forward these kinds of defenses, where when you stop and say to yourself, what is going on here? The answer is that you're making a set of factual allegations in a pleading, their handouts all around, that just cannot be explained in a coherent way. Either you own a dog and it doesn't bite, or you own the dog and it bites, but it was tied up. Or, the other common law example, which is you come to me and say you borrowed a tea kettle from me and you returned it to me cracked. And I respond by the classical common law response. First of all, I never borrowed a tea kettle from you. Second of all, if I did borrow a tea kettle from you, I returned it without a crack. And third of all, if I borrowed a tea kettle from you and I returned the crack, it was because I borrowed a crack. Now you stop to say, huh? How can you do that? You put forward three defenses, each of which requires a factual underpinning that's inconsistent with the other one. It almost sounds like perjury. It almost sounds like perjury to put forward inconsistent alternative pleadings. And it's an ongoing issue in the common law, but it more or less reflects a common law problem, which is the common law didn't really take perjury so seriously. What do I mean by that? It thought that lying was limited to very specific technical activities in court making statements. And you could, in general, put forward, as a matter of common law, wildly inconsistent defenses, even though when you stop to look at these wildly inconsistent defenses, one of them had to be a lie. Jewish law has a very well worked out way for dealing with this, and I want to spend my time here today focusing on a whole different intellectual approach. My goal is to both explain to you a little bit about procedure in a rabbinical court. My goal is also to share with you how you deal with alternative pleading. And the third is to reinforce some sort of an ethical concept. If I'm very lucky, I'll even explain to you a series of Talmudic insights that you've encountered many times, but in fact have no idea what's really going on. If I can get them all done, it's been an exceptionally good 45 minutes. If I can get even one or two of them done, maybe it's okay. The Talmud uses the term migo, frequently to refer to pleadings in the alternative. And as anybody studying Talmud encounters it, you scratch your head and say, I don't understand how this works. Why should it be that I can win on a claim that I can't prove because I have a claim that I can prove? That doesn't really make any sense at all. So I want to stop to explain to you what's going on. Jewish law says as follows. If I have a defense that allows me to triumph in my litigation in front of you, And triumph means if I say this is what happened, you cannot disprove it. So I win. If I have such a defense, even if it's false, the fact that I have such a defense buttresses my believability when I give a different defense, which is in fact
true.
So let's go back to my tea kettle example. You come to me and say, you borrowed the tea kettle, and at the time that I lent it to you, it was unbroken, and yet when you returned it to me, you returned it to me broken. I respond to you by saying, I never borrowed the teacup from you, the tea kettle from you, so I don't have to pay you. What do you have to do to defeat that response? You have to prove that the loan happened. If you can't prove that the loan happened, then what happens? It ends right there. And that's a well-established principle of Jewish law. So now I respond to you by saying, look, I did borrow the tea kettle from you, but when I returned it to you, it was not cracked. But I can't prove that it wasn't cracked. But you know what? You can't prove that I borrowed it. And my claim that I'm telling you the truth, that I returned the teacup whole, should be supported by the fact that if I was a nefarious, no good liar who was happily content to lie for money, you know what I would have said to you?
I never borrowed it.
So I'm prepared to acknowledge the truth. The truth is that I did borrow this teacup from you, but I want to get credit for the fact that I'm telling you a truth against my best interest. And the credit I want to get is I want the court system to acknowledge that if all I wanted to do was do anything to win, I could have lied right here and won. From the fact that I acknowledge the truth right here should force the court system to acknowledge that my claim that I returned it to you whole must also be true. Because if I were just going to do anything it took to win, I would have won in a much simpler way, which I would have simply denied what? That I borrowed it. Now, this method of pleading is relatively unique to Jewish law, but it's important to understand what it doesn't accomplish. When I turn to you and say, since you can't prove that I borrowed the tea kettle, you should be believing me when I say that I returned it unbroken. How do you respond? You respond by saying, well, what are you talking about? I had here the signed letter you signed before I lent you the teacup saying you acknowledged the borrowing of the teacup, so that claim goes out the window. The purpose of the whole Jewish law claim of Mido, of pleading in the alternative, is to allow a person who has a false claim, but a false claim that he could win on, to not have to say the false claim is true, but to instead allow him to triumph under the false claim by dint of the fact that he should get credit for a false claim that he doesn't press. So I see I've lost you all already. So we're going to start again because meaning the term Mido comes up some 75 times in the Talmud. The first 38 times you encounter it, you say, oh, this is sort of like a divine Torah decree, which gives me credibility for no reason. But it's not at all true. This analysis is not from a verse in the Torah. It's straightforward rabbinic logic. And the rabbinic logic here is one that I've always found persuasive, and it reflects an underlying value, which is the rabbis didn't want to turn to honorable people and say the only way an honorable person can triumph in the face of a dishonorable person is if he does what?
He lies.
Elsewhere I've written that the rabbis were very much concerned with the great American philosopher Billy Joel's fear that only the good die young. What do I mean by that? The rabbis didn't want to create a model in which you have to be a lowlife to deal with lowlifes. So when somebody comes to me and says, you borrowed my tea kettle and you returned it broken. So if I'm an honest person,
I'll say the truth, which is, I did borrow your teacup, I did return it, and it was not broken. The problem I have here is as follows. Having acknowledged that I did borrow it, and I did return it, the burden of proof to prove that I returned it whole falls on who? On me. And because I didn't even know that this allegation was coming down the pipe, you know what I didn't do? I didn't take out my cell camera before I returned the tea kettle and take a picture of it. So now I'm in big trouble. And the only reason why I'm in big trouble, from my perspective, is because I'm dealing with a guy who is dishonest. He's putting forward what I know to be a false claim. Furthermore, he's only putting forward it against me because you know what he knows about me? I'm an honest fool. And I'll say the truth. The truth is that, yes, I borrowed it. Yes, I returned it. And no, it wasn't broken. And he'll say, great. You acknowledged you borrowed it, so I don't have to prove that. You acknowledged you returned it, so I don't have to prove it. And we're in a fight now about whether it was returned broken or not. Here's the broken teacup. That creates a presumption that you returned it broken. Now you must prove you didn't return it broken. So the rabbis were terribly afraid that the legal rules would respond to this by saying, okay, the good guy loses yet again. It's sort of a price for being honest. And in general, Jewish law was incredibly afraid of creating systems in which good guys always lose. Where when an honest person confronts a dishonest person, the only way the honest person can win is by becoming dishonest. The Jewish tradition says that gives incredibly what the secular legal community calls disincentive. It says to people, don't be good, be bad, because if you're bad, you'll win, and if you're good, you'll lose. So the rabbi stopped to focus on this problem and to give a very elegant alternative solution that's not only about pleading, but it's also about moral values in the legal system. The rabbi said, when a good person who's shown a pattern of truth-telling comes forward and says a story where he had any number of opportunities to win by lying, but he passed up the opportunity to win by lying and insists on telling the truth, that provides support for the truth that he's given, even if the truth that he's given is unsupported. The reason why I should be believed to tell you that I returned the tea kettle unbroken is because I've shown that I'm an honest guy by dint of the fact that if I were a dishonest guy, I would have denied borrowing it. And my claim that I returned it broken should thus be believed in the face of the fact that if I was interested in triumphing for no reason, I would have said I never borrowed your teacup. Now, as the Shach observes, this doesn't work in a highly documented society. In a highly documented society, you almost never have pleas in the alternative. Because when I go to borrow the teacup from you, what do you make me do? Sign for it. None of you sign for it, but you sign a form which says what? I inspected it and it's not broken. And when I return the teacup to you, you know what I make you do? I pull out the form that you gave me and I say, return to the same condition. So the Shach already observed that Migos are not designed to regulate the conduct of sophisticated players. Because sophisticated players save themselves by doing what? Over-documentation. When you go to Hertz to rent a car, they don't rent you a car because you're a sweet guy who smiles nicely. They rent you a car because you filled out the form. And when you go back to Hertz to return the car, you don't return the car without getting the form back because the clerk is a sweet person who smiled nicely. The Shach's observation is that what the rabbis were intending to do was to deal with normal interpersonal relationships in a time and place where you're in a society where some people, you know what they are? Very honest. And you know what some people are? Honest. And some people are dishonest. And some people are dishonest, but only when they're sure they can't get caught. And in this society, the social routine in life is what don't you do? You don't document. I live in the South. It's a different environment here. I have a yard. And not only do I have a yard, but I have a lawnmower. And being a southerly person, occasionally neighbors come to me, you know what they say? Can I borrow your lawnmower? Other places they say, can I borrow your shotgun? But other Jewish neighbors would say, can I borrow your lawnmower? I say to them, sure. And what's the procedure for borrowing my lawnmower? They take it. Do I turn to them and say, here's the lawnmower lending form, and let's go out together and inspect the lawnmower? I don't say it. And when they bring it back to me, you know what I say? Just put it over there. I don't say, let's go out and inspect the lawnmower together. I don't do this. I run these informal activities based on a social love and trust, which is normal in a small community. Sometimes one person in this small social community isn't so loving and trusting or isn't so honest. And if you're not careful in that situation, you create a social construct in which the only way good people triumph is by falling into the same mud the bad people are comfortably operating in and responding to a lie by doing what? A counter lie. Michael Osterveld said. Michael is my research assistant. Michael Osterveld worked for me at Emory for 6 years, 7 years, well, 5 years, a long time. And almost everything I've written in the last 5 years is a reflection of his involvement in my life at Emory. He's a 2L at Columbia and a good fellow. Wanted to know that. A very good fellow. The truth is that the system we use here is designed to encourage people to say the truth. And because the system is designed to encourage people to say the truth, what we want people to do here is say a truth in response to a lie and let the chips fall where they may. But we're very much afraid if we let the chips fall where they may, people will learn that if they tell the truth, they lose. So the me too claim, the pleading and the alternative, is reflective of the fact that what we want people to do in this situation is say the truth, whatever the truth is, and then we, the court system, looks over the full recounting of the story to determine whose recounting of the total picture is... I'm sorry? Somebody said a word.
Honest.
Right. Whose recounting of the whole picture is honest? Not whose recounting of this specific claim is to be believed, but when you say you borrowed the kettle, you returned it and it was broken, and I say I borrowed the kettle and I returned it and it was not broken, my total claim is more believable than your total claim, because had I wanted to deal with you in a nefarious way, I would have simply said I never borrowed it.
If I think that both the question of my borrowing and the question of the condition it came back in are going to be unclear fact questions, don't I have an incentive to falsely admit to one of them to get the benefit of the doubt and accept them?
No, give me an example.
So I'm worried that if I can't. We're not going to be able to prove whether or not I borrowed it, that's going to be disputed.
Right.
And that the condition it came back in is also going to be.
Right. So if the person who says I borrowed it can't prove that I actually borrowed it, then I win. Meaning uncertain facts are resolved in favor of
the defendant. But I don't know how that's going to come out.
Right.
It may be that they prove that up.
Right. So
if I were making a strategic decision, why would I say, well, you know, if I don't know how the first one's going to come out, the second one's going to come out, why don't I falsely admit the first one to get the needle on the second one?
No, because you can't. Having admitted that I borrowed it, I don't understand your question. Start me again. I don't have a problem. The system presupposes that you gain everybody gains everything. We want to make sure that the people who insist on gaining truthfully get the same advantage as the people who gain it not truthfully. So I go to you and say, you borrowed the tea kettle. You borrowed the tea kettle, and when you returned it, it was broken. You know the truth. The truth is that you did borrow it from me, and when you returned it to me, it was not broken. Let's assume you are a nefarious guy. I know that's not true, but let's assume you are a nefarious guy. How would you gain the system? In the common law, you would advance all your claims. I never borrowed it. If I borrowed it, I returned it and it wasn't broken. And if I did return it broken, it's because I borrowed it. In the halakhic system, you can't advance all of these claims incompatibly. What do?
You're assuming that when you present your case, you already know what the proofs are going to be.
Right.
You're assuming that you know whether there's a witness who's going to say you borrowed it or not.
No, I think the halakhic system doesn't know what the other side has either. But it encourages
you.
You
know it's not going to do you any good.
Absolutely, because if in fact he has a witness to prove you borrowed it, then the fact that you returned it unbroken becomes a genuinely unprovable matter, and you should lose. Meaning, it is true that as a matter of Jewish law, you might in fact not win. Lots of cases you might in fact not win. But in a situation in which he can prove you borrowed it, and he can prove that you returned it, but you can't prove that you returned it whole, in Jewish law you lose. And by the way, in the common law you lose also. Because the presumption is that you were supposed to return it on the condition that you borrowed it, and you can't prove you fulfilled that condition, you lose. It's 100% true that in Jewish law, you might in fact lose even when in God's eyes you're supposed to win, but you don't have any disadvantage from telling the truth.
Yeah, but I think what people are saying is, once you know the din of amigo might apply in your scenario, it may give you an encouragement to lie to gain the system. So
that's an extremely important observation. The question here is, what causes me to gain the system? What's the disincentive upon me to gain the system by lying? And now here's an excellent answer. The Gemara tells us, and this is also followed in Jewish law, that when I get into the system, the habit of lying and forfeiting, and I get caught lying, all burdens are shifted against me. Let me give you an example in Jewish law. I have an employee, and I promise my employee at the end of every day's wages, I'll give him $100 for his day's wages. At the end of the day, I putatively pay my employee. My employee comes back the next day and says, "You never paid me yesterday." I say, "I did pay you." Who wins? The answer is as follows. The employer has to keep records, and the employee wins unless the employer can prove he was paid. Because each side has equal credibility, and the rabbis assigned the duty to hold the records to the employer. But there's one exception to that case. Once the employee is shown to be a person who lies for profit, then he no longer has the right to say, "You carry your burden." He has to carry his own burden, and he can't because he's proven to be a liar. Hooks up chakra, the person who files false court proceedings once, now loses his ability to ever burden shift to the other side. So it might well be that I can sometimes game the system being aware of the fact that there's a meagle, but it comes at an enormous cost to me. I lose the ability, as a matter of Jewish law, to file any future proceedings in which I seek to shift the burden to the other side. This is part. I'm sorry?
Unless I win. I get away with
it. Of course, but you take it at that point. What Jewish law does is very fascinating. And here, by the way, there's echoes of American procedural law. The greatest cost of perjury is you lose the ability to testify in the future. In American law, because your credibility is discounted. In Jewish law, because you're simply not allowed to testify. Many matters of court proceedings are really, in fact, not determined by who has truth, but by who bears the burden. So when I go to Dan and say, "You ripped my suit," and Dan says, "I didn't rip your suit," I have no proof and Dan has no proof. How come? Because neither one of us has. Who wins now? Dan wins. Because Dan says, "Hamosi mechaveiro." Otherwise, the person who wishes to collect money needs to prove, I can't prove, he can't prove, thus he wins. But if he's well known, or not even well known, the court has established that he's a liar, at that point the burden is shifted, and he no longer can say, Havosi mechaveiro alavaraya, and he himself becomes a target for every scam, because he's no longer eligible to testify. What the Jewish tradition here is trying to do goes back to the phenomenon of keeping the players in the system properly incentivized to testify honestly. And if you don't create systems like that, the halakhic tradition tells us, what happens is people testify falsely all the time because there's no long-term consequence to false testimony.
Maybe this might be a topic there, but if the fact that socks were not are kept confidential, can't somebody theoretically come in the basement multiple times, plead a case that they know there's no real way of proving or disproving mm-hmm. for the other side to defend, you know,
right.
defending, and then just come in and use the basement as a way to...
Yes, and there are any number of good resolutions to this, both in theory and in practice. In some idealized world, there'd be a centralized process for keeping track of rabbinical court orders everywhere. And in Israel, that's more or less what they do because it's a governmental system. In the United States, what Batei Din do when they encounter these kinds of egregious cases is they publicize a process for saying this person came into rabbinical court and lied to us, and other rabbinical courts should be aware of that fact, even if they don't publicize the totality of the psak, they'll nonetheless publicize the fact that this person came in and testified falsely.
Maybe I'm not making the question clear. If you haven't proven, right, in the case of the general election, you haven't proven that they in fact are lying.
So right.
A plaintiff could come in multiple times into the basement of America, lie as a plaintiff, right?
Right.
Win a case, and because it hasn't been proven, they'll just use the basement of America.
No, but in most of the cases, the plaintiff has a burden. It's only in the case of the defendant.
But if they bring in honest defendants.
Right. So honest defendants.
Win every time, and there's a pattern of this plaintiff bringing in cases, but there's no way to even know that that's occurring.
No, I don't think that that's correct, because the plaintiff who brings in an honest defendant, the honest defendant is told, recount your story from A to Z, and even if your final position acknowledges part of the defendant's story, from the meagre alternative pleading, you ultimately win. So defendant, plaintiff brings the defendant and says, you borrowed my tea kettle, you returned it, it was broken. Defendant says, I did borrow the tea kettle, I did return it, it wasn't broken. The dayanim turns to the plaintiff and say, can you prove he borrowed the tea kettle? And if the answer is no, then even though the defendant has acknowledged that he returned it, but denied he returned it broken, nonetheless the defendant wins.
I want to present a case in point. I have a rabbi who lectured in the rabbi, but he's very legalistic, so I think I could let him never borrow so much use this argument. Let's just say one would be under the belief they have, I wouldn't use the word right, to borrow something, but that was not the case. Does that become a crime of conversion? That the person that put something in law?
So if I borrow something without permission, that's a form of conversion, it's a form of theft.
So you see, not a good thing to just borrow without some kind of documentation.
No, there's a difference between borrowing without documentation and borrowing without permission. In a routine social society, people borrow without written permission all the time. And what the Chachamim recognized is that when you can say to people, only borrow with written permission, it does not reflect at all the sociology of the society. And that you have to have provisions in place to reflect the fact that I borrow the lawnmower from you, you don't take a picture, I don't take a picture, and I return a damage to you. And then I deny that I returned the damage to you. How do you deal with that situation? You can say you should only borrow with permission, but saying you should only borrow with permission reflects a level of legalism that doesn't at all reflect how society really works.
Well, just following through on that, you borrow the detail, you break it, you return it. You borrow from accused you of returning it broken, and you say, yes, I borrowed it, yes, I returned it, but it wasn't broken. So now you're using the legal, and you're not really entitled to it, you win.
Of course, but the answer to that is very important. Since the dayanim look at this case and have no idea what the truth really is, the person who says the tea kettle was broken when he returned it is only really entitled to triumph if he can show that it was borrowed and returned. Otherwise, the whole situation smells peculiar. That's why Hertz is so good. Hertz is no dummy. They're in the business of renting out cars. When I go to Hertz to rent out a car, they insist that I review the car before I borrow it, I sign now with all the damage noted, and I return it noting on whatever damage occurred. Exactly because in this kind of situation where I borrow the tea kettle and I return it, I say I returned it unbroken, and you say you returned it broken. It's very hard to know the truth. It's plaintiff should only win if he can document the correctness of his claim in every step of the way. Otherwise, it's too easy for plaintiff to triumph on what's in the underlining of a false claim.
Is there any conceptual difference between a Mego raised by a defendant and a Mego raised sui sponte by the Dionet?
No, but there are no Megos raised by the plaintiff. You can only use a Mego as a shield, and you cannot use a Mego as a sword, to invoke the American law historic analogy. I can't ever collect money from you with a pleading in the alternative. I can only use pleading in the alternative to prevent me from having to pay money.
I have two questions. In the case where the borrower returns the tea kettle and it's broken, and he admits that he borrowed it, so you would say that the burden of proof is on him. Is that based on the idea of chazaka or cheska shabur that it was? Because right now it's broken and we assume that...
Well, we have a reasonable set of assumptions. The reasonable set of assumptions is that when he borrowed it, it was whole. Because if at the time that he had borrowed it, it was broken, you know what he would have said?
I'm not
going to borrow it. Or I'm borrowing it, but you should know it's broken. And that's fine as well. So when he returns it broken, but he had no comment about when he borrowed it, the assumption is that he borrowed it functional and he returned it dysfunctional. That's exactly the structure of these kinds of claims. I think that the purpose here is to try to create a legal system in which the plaintiff and the defendant are both supposed to step forward and recount their whole claim from beginning to end. When the plaintiff's claim on the totality of the picture can be proven every step of the way, or even rings as more true than the defendant's, the plaintiff wins. In the absence of that assertion, the defendant ought to triumph, even if the defendant cannot prove what? The penultimate step that at some technical level is necessary, which is, I return the tea kettle unbroken. To require the defendant to not prove that he borrowed it, and not prove that he returned it, but prove that he returned it unbroken, when the plaintiff can't prove that it was borrowed, struck the Chachamim as at its core unjust. By the way, it strikes the common law as unjust too. The way the common law deals with it, though, is the amazing part. The common law deals with it, in essence, by saying to the defendant, in this case, you know what you should do? Perjury. What you should do here, you say it's not perjury. Dan, I understand it's not perjury in the technical sense of the word, but a lawyer and the client have to submit a pleading that he attests is true.
Sure, but and it says that in the first block quote that you put in the packet that one of the motivations is that you're required, you have to generally raise all these defenses prior to any discovery or their waived, and so. In some ways, the common law is just acknowledging that at the point that you put in your answer, you typically don't know very much. And yet, if you don't put stuff in, you get faulted for it later, and so they give you very wide leeway. So you put all sorts of things in.
Right, but the things that you put in are things that you would definitively know are false. Meaning, let's go back to the, I don't own a dog. That's part of my defense. Let's say the racehorse. Meaning, you can put in alternative defenses that you yourself know at the time that you're putting them forward are false. That's amazing.
I know that not all of them can be found true, but I don't know which the court is going to find.
Right, but you know that some of them are, in fact, factually false vis-a-vis yourself.
No, I disagree that that's what happens.
I think that that's an amazing structure that you can put forward in an alternative pleading claims that are factually false. That the defendant himself knows to be factually false. I think that Jewish law is designed to overcome that and to find a process for giving the defendant credit. Credit in the legal sense of the word of having a defense that he doesn't put forward as true, but that he could have put forward as true if he was nefarious.
Isn't there a Jewish law?
You have to speak up.
Isn't there a Jewish law concept that you swear establish?
No, swearing only works in the absence of any sort of testimonial evidence at all. I'm not going to deal here with the with what is the legal way of taking an oath as opposed to any other form of truth. But rest assured, when I come to you and say you owe me $50, and Joe and Harry are my witnesses, you say, well, I swear I don't owe you $50. Nonetheless, the court system says, give him the $50. Not only that,
You don't
even get to swear. That's right. You can swear all you want, but the oaths that you butter are of the vulgar kind. Or even, I go to you and say, you owe me $50. I have no witnesses, but you know what I have? I have a letter of indebtedness from you, an IOU, in which you say you owe me $50. You want to take an oath that you never borrowed $50 from it? You get laughed at. Oaths only work in very, very, very particular kinds of cases where there's very vague kinds of proof. They don't work. You're not allowed to swear in any situation in which there's a scintilla's worth of proof on the table against what you want to say. I saw a hand up somewhere back there.
We have discussed a case where, yes, it's broken out, but it was leaking also when I borrowed it. Sure, it leaks now.
I don't want to deal with the question of mace machos molacho, which is it grew worse in the course of my borrowing, because that's a very fact-driven case. But if my defense is it was broken when I borrowed it, so that's a very easy case to deal with from the perspective of Jewish law. That kind of defense has to be put forward by the defendant, and it's presumptively false, because the presumption is that the defendant doesn't borrow objects that are broken and are defective. And so he could advance that, but what would he have to do? He'd have to prove it. Could be he could prove it.
Yeah, it's concealed that it's going to leak. I mean,
could be.
I mean, I don't know. For me, it's been an I've been educated from my family, and my grandmother's brother is a medical doctor and a lawyer, and this is a concept for my family that you just don't borrow something like that.
Okay, I don't have a problem. It's not a bad sociology. I don't know. Most people, I think, borrow things without documents.
I mean, it's a risk. Why put yourself in predicament where there could be a change of position, and next thing you know, you can step back and they say you don't have permission to borrow something.
Okay. So again, I'm not a sociologist, but how many of you in the room have borrowed stuff without permit, without getting written documentation?
I mean,
you look around, you see the sociology is just not. I don't have a problem with your vision of sociology. It's just, it's just not the case. It's just not the case. Michael.
So from a strict math logical point of view, you may take the statement A or B or C. That statement itself is true as long as one of the propositions in there is true.
Right.
If you make a statement in court, A or B or C, why interpret it as lying if, in fact, one of them can be true?
So the common law, I mean, you're definitely explaining the common law response. I guess the Jewish tradition says, when I go into court and I say, I didn't borrow the tea kettle, or if I borrowed the tea kettle, it was broken when I borrowed it, or... If the tea kettle was not broken when I borrowed it, I returned it to you unbroken, comes sufficiently close to a false statement that you're better off providing a legal structure that allows me to make my true statement, and I get credit for making a demonstrably true statement that validates claims that I didn't make and I'm not factually averring for. I think that's the Jewish tradition finds that case to be too socially complicated, and in all of our other interactions in life, we would call a person who says A or B or C to be a liar. That's how we would socially view that kind of conversation, and so we find it awkward to allow people to advance them in court.
If you change your fact pattern slightly, then the person that borrowed it knew that he gave it back correct, but said that he did borrow it, and he gave it back, and it was not broken.
Right.
Right? Are you then rewarding him? Is that the same thing you think in
finding him? Sure, but he's a nefarious person, and he's prepared. I mean, if he's an honest person, he knows he borrowed it whole, he cracked it, and he returned it. If he's an honest person, what does he say?
I'll repay you for it.
If he's a dishonest person, he can do something much stronger than what you're saying. He can say, I never borrowed it. So the plaintiff in that case is no worse off, because once he's prepared, in essence, the person who's dishonest in that situation gains no advantage, because all he can do is he can just lie the whole thing through and say, I never borrowed it, and just doesn't even have to return it broken. He can just keep it. So the plaintiff in that case is no worse off, whether the defendant is honest or dishonest. He gets the same result, which is he's screwed out of his money. But the legal system here remains intact one way or another. So I wanted to share this with you, not just because it helps explain, if you're a regular Gemara learner, a concept that you encounter throughout all of Nezikin. I mean, this is an ongoing concept that runs throughout all of the shots. And it's easy to gloss over it and not have any idea of what's going on. But it's also important to understand it because it underlies a value. The value, I think, is important on an ethical level. The value goes as follows. Sometimes people say to themselves, oh, when I'm in court, my general ethical duties completely disappear, and I can play the game by the rules, or whatever the rules might be. And there's some truth to that. And there is some truth to that. But I think that the Chachamim wanted to craft a legal system that encouraged people to be as ethical as they could in all situations. And you can't just say to people, be good. It's easy to say to people, be good. But when you say to people, be good, and then you'll get whacked, and don't worry, God will reward you, that discourages rather than encourages good behavior. The way you have to encourage good behavior in a legal system is you have to say, let's reward conduct that's consistent with the ethical values that we want to reward. And I think the rabbis thought that given a choice between the common law, either A or B or C, or forcing a person to say A, and from the fact that I'm telling you definitively that A is what happened, I should get rewarded for the fact that I could have said B or C and won, encourages a system of more honest and ethical dealing. Ultimately, I think that the rabbis thought that honest and ethical dealing prior to litigation, in a general construct of encouraging people to deal with each other in an above-board, honest, ethical way, that's the process that we need to encourage people to build an ethical legal system. Thank you very much. And it's been a pleasure to be here. I want to publicly thank Rabbi Weissman for organizing this wonderful event as well. Have a good day.